Hi there, it's Marco. Before we get started, I wanted to share some great news. We surpassed the goal for our end-of-year fundraiser. Since the beginning of November, we've been asking you to donate to support the world. From every corner of the globe, people like you answered the call. We raised more than $75,000 to help keep our show going for another year. Your generosity means that our correspondents, editors, and producers can continue to bring you the coverage that you rely on. And it means so much to our entire team to know that you're with us. So thank you once again from all of us here at The World. Now, on with the show.
A year ago today, a mob stormed the U.S. Capitol. Their reach is global.
There are movements that were there at the Capitol on January 6th that have a much wider reach than just the United States.
Also today, Russian troops have arrived in Kazakhstan to quell protests. Judging from online posts, Kazakhs aren't happy about it.
People are writing messages of disappointment. They're saying our president just sold us to Russia, sold our independence.
I'm Carol Hills, and the Olympics are a month away. For the athletes, now is normally the time to focus on the final training push.
But that stuff seems somewhat secondary, at least for the next 30 days. I think your first priority is making sure that you stay healthy and avoid COVID.
Plus, the unvaccinated Australian saga of tennis star Novak Djokovic. All ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. I'll allow no one to place a dagger at the throat of democracy. That was President Biden's vow today in a speech marking the one-year anniversary of the storming of the U.S. Capitol. Biden told Americans they are living at an inflection point in history, both at home and abroad.
From China to Russia and beyond, they're betting that democracy's days are numbered. They actually told me democracy is too slow, too bogged down by division to succeed in today's rapidly changing, complicated world. And they're betting America will become more like them and less like us.
Heidi Beirich is also worried about America becoming more like its adversaries abroad. Beirich is the co-founder of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism. Heidi Beirich, to what extent is the extremism we saw on display on Capitol Hill 1 year ago today a global phenomenon?
Down to the specific groups that showed up at the Capitol, such as the Proud Boys, a misogynistic, hateful organization, and militia groups like the Three Percenters, these are not confined to our borders. In fact, Canada banned the Proud Boys just a few days after January 6th for concerns that the group would destabilize that country. So there are movements that were there at the Capitol on January 6th that have a much wider reach than just the United States. Those are problems that we find all across many, many countries.
Let's take someone like Martin Sellner, the head of the identitarian movement in Austria. He's one leading alt-right figure who's gotten a lot of traction from the imagery of the Capitol Hill insurrection. Who is he and how has he used January 6th?
Martin Sellner is a major figure in international white supremacy. And his ideas, particularly his spreading of the idea of the Great Replacement, this idea that white people are being displaced in their home countries, sometimes at the hands of Jews, by people of color, this is something he has spread and something we've now heard from Tucker Carlson. He uses January 6th, which he thinks was too disorganized to be effective, but he says those are patriots, and if they were organized correctly, they could be forces to change the world into what he wants, which is basically all white states in various countries in Europe, the United States, Canada, and so on.
And just to put Sellner in context, what sort of a following does he have in Austria?
It's massive. The group itself has had its symbols banned by the Austrian government because of this connection with the Christchurch shooter. The shooter was a big fan of Sellner's, gave money to the group.
That was in New Zealand.
Yeah, in New Zealand. There's probably several thousand members in Austria. Generation Identity, this group has also been banned in France. So it's a threat to various states. Its ideas are a threat, and they have members all across Europe.
I know the Proud Boys were active in Canada, but then recently banned. Four of its leaders have been indicted for conspiracy in the Capitol Hill riot. Are they still able to work at an international level?
Well, they're having difficulty in Canada, and that largely has to do with the fact that there are financial repercussions, like you can't have a bank account. But that doesn't mean that there aren't members who are affiliated in Canada. We also know that there are Proud Boys in places like the United Kingdom. And once you get onto the online forums on Telegram that the Proud Boys run, you find people from all over the world who are attracted to their messaging.
What about QAnon? How global is it?
It has been found in dozens and dozens of countries, including places like Japan, which has a pretty large QAnon cohort. And what's happened in these other countries is they fit the conspiracy theory to local issues. And QAnon folks in places like Germany and France and other countries have been showing up at anti-vax and anti-lockdown protests in those countries. And a lot of European countries are really concerned that that's going to come with violence.
It's surprising to hear that about QAnon because as a group, it sounds almost clownish as opposed to dangerous.
It does sound clownish, and its ideas are absolutely absurd, and yet they hold incredible attraction in places. And the fact is that social media is able to spread these messages, recruit people across borders. I mean, it's basically a borderless world online.
Can you give an example of how the QAnon idea has translated into another country?
For example, in parts of Eastern Europe, QAnon saviors have become people like Viktor Orban, the strongman leader of Hungary. And so you displace Trump for other leaders, but you still believe that there are these plots going on by global elites related to child sex trafficking, related to, you know, hidden forces in politics. You just kind of change the leadership depending on the location that you're at.
When it comes to questioning elections and the underpinnings of democracy, can you give us some examples of how these U.S.-based extremist groups are actually exporting tactics and strategies to people abroad?
Yeah, the Stop the Steal idea is now being picked up in other countries. I wouldn't be surprised as we see elections this year in places like the Philippines and in Hungary if the same idea that the election is being manipulated because there's not a favored outcome, meaning Viktor Orban doesn't win, for example, in Hungary, there's going to be the same kind of ideas spreading in those places, the same kinds of attacks on election infrastructure. So Donald Trump, when he started talking about elections being stolen, has now injected this idea into a lot of democracies, especially fragile ones in places like Eastern Europe and other parts of the world, that the elections just aren't free and fair. They never are. If you don't get the outcome you want, there's something wrong with the system.
My last question is, we've been talking a lot about how U.S.-based extremist groups are exporting tactics and strategies, but is there a reverse situation going on? Are there overseas groups that have been able to influence U.S. domestic politics?
Yeah, you really have to think about extremist networks as flowing both ways. For example, the Russian Imperial Movement, which is headquartered out of St. Petersburg, has worked with American white supremacists. There are neo-Nazi networks that are very scary that really have their headquarters outside of the United States and have brought those ideas to American extremists. And I should say that the Great Replacement Theory, which is now something Tucker Carlson and Newt Gingrich and other GOP stalwarts talk about, actually was originally an idea come up with by a Frenchman. So these trends work both directions.
Heidi Beirich is the co-founder of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism. She's been talking with us about how U.S. extremist groups are exporting their ideas abroad. Thanks, Heidi.
Thank you.
Russian troops are now arriving in Kazakhstan. A Russian-led military alliance is sending troops to help quell protests and violence in the former Soviet state. In Kazakhstan's biggest city, Almaty, there are reports today of the Kazakh military shooting at protesters. Gunfire captured on video by the Russian TASS news agency. Multiple casualties have been reported. The protests in Kazakhstan began over the weekend over steep hikes in gas prices. Torokhol Dorov is the Kazakh service director at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and joins us now from Prague. Torokhol, what have you heard from reporters working on the ground in Kazakhstan? I mean, what's the latest?
We have just spoken to our journalists in Almaty about an hour and a half ago. There was a gunfire opened at demonstrators on the main square of Almaty, where several hundreds of peaceful demonstrators gathered. They were holding posters with slogans like, "We are not terrorists." It was kind of an answer to the president, Kasym-Jomart Tokayev, who called demonstrators terrorists in his yesterday's statement when he asked help from this CSTO organization, which is collective security treaty organization created by several post-Soviet countries, including Russia and Kazakhstan.
What is the current status of the Kazakh government there?
Current status of Kazakh government, president, from time to time, he appears with television statements. They are spreading information through the Ministry of Interior and nothing more. In many cities, what we have been witnessing today through our journalists, that there is disruption in work of public transportation, in banks, many big malls do not work. People do not know where to buy food, for example, in some places of Almaty, what we heard in Shymkent. ATMs do not work, even though we have seen big lines of people for ATMs in other cities where it worked, because people are trying to get cash since online banking did not work.
We're seeing reports that Russian troops, or their so-called peacekeepers, as Russia is calling them, that they've entered Kazakhstan. Is this legal? And what does that mean for Kazakhstan?
Is that legal? It's a very interesting question, because Kazakhstan is a member of the organization CSTO.
That's the Collective Security Treaty Organization, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And the president asked for help. And CSTO usually do not intervene in internal conflicts in the country. But this time, president used a different term, saying that these are terrorists. And CSTO, in its charter, it says that it also fights against terrorism. What we heard from Russian news agencies, they're already in Almaty, but we don't know exactly whether they started their operation or not, because our journalists couldn't see any presence of Russian troops in the cities.
So as you said, Kazakhstan's president, Kasym-Jomart Tokayev, he's called for this military assistance. And by calling the protesters terrorists, that these Russian troops can come in, according to this Collective Security Treaty Organization. But is anyone in Kazakhstan going to be welcoming this Russian military presence?
That's a really great question, because since president announced that last night, we hearing only disappointment. Whenever internet appears in Kazakhstan, people are saying our president just sold us to Russia, sold our independence. And I myself couldn't see any message welcoming Russian troops.
What's the relationship been between Russia and Kazakhstan at the government level in recent years?
Between Kazakhstan and Russia, the relationship was always good, because Kazakhstan has been ruled by one man of last 30 years. And Russia has been ruled by only one man for more than 20 years. They had really good relationship. And at the same time, analysts are saying that Nazarbayev, our former president, has been playing with the Kremlin very carefully. Because between these two countries, their longest border is lying. Because these regions of northern Kazakhstan were always a headache for local authorities in Kazakhstan, because they are mainly populated by ethnic Russians. And since Crimea annexation, for Kazakhstan, it was quite a dangerous question. And Kazakh authorities were always supporting Russia and trying to keep good relationship in order not to go into confrontation with them.
So there's a long relationship. And as you mentioned, the former president of Kazakhstan, Nursultan Nazarbayev, he was in power for 30 years, and a lot of that coincided with Putin's rule as well.
Definitely. And also, Kazakhstan is mainly bilingual country, the largest group of Russian-speaking population, even though many of them are ethnic Kazakhs, but they usually speak Russian.
Finally, as a person from the region, what have the last couple of days meant for you? I mean, where do you think this is going?
I have really bad kind of feeling that, you know, there will be more blood. We are losing hope that it will end with good changes. I think if Russian troops will be there, probably their repression will be even more, and it will be quite difficult.
Torkel Dorov is the Kazakh service director at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. He's been talking with us about the protests that are happening across Kazakhstan. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, Novak Djokovic is having a very bad day. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Novak Djokovic, the world's number one tennis star, is supposed to be on the courts right now, preparing to defend his Australian Open title. Instead, the Serbian player is in immigration detention in Melbourne, fighting deportation, all because of questions about a COVID vaccine exemption. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
Novak Djokovic's supporters gathered outside the Melbourne quarantine hotel where he's being held. Many were from the Australian-Serbian community. They were waving Serbian flags and singing protest songs. One woman told news cameras that Djokovic is a victim in all of this.
It's not fair. It's being discriminating against him just because he chooses not to state his vax status. I mean, it is a personal choice.
Djokovic landed at the Melbourne airport on Wednesday night with a medical exemption in hand, which should have, in theory, allowed him to enter the country even though he's not vaccinated. Instead, border officials detained him for hours, his visa was revoked, and now he's sitting in an immigration detention hotel. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison declared he would be deported.
Rules are rules, and there are no special cases. Ultimately, this is the responsibility of the traveler.
Djokovic has been dismissive toward the pandemic. He's said he's opposed to vaccines and has been coy about stating his vaccination status. In June of 2020, when the pandemic was raging, he organized a tournament in Serbia. There was no social distancing, and the players were even filmed dancing in a nightclub. Several players, including Djokovic, later tested positive for the coronavirus. That's why lots of Australians were surprised, some even outraged, when Djokovic announced a few days ago on his Instagram that Tennis Australia and the state of Victoria had granted him a vaccine waiver. People told the BBC that the exemption was a slap in the face.
We've all done the right thing. We've all gone out and got our jabs and our boosters, and we have someone that's come from overseas, and all of a sudden he's been exempt and can play, and I think it's an absolute disgrace.
Maybe everyone here is so sick of being under so many strict rules, they think everyone else should, well, you abide by them too. We've done the hard yards. Maybe you can do it too for a couple of weeks.
At the same time, many people believe the way Djokovic's case was handled is kind of embarrassing. Former immigration official Abul Rizvi told ABC News in Australia that if the federal government didn't want Djokovic in the country, they should have stepped in much earlier.
Mr. Djokovic's visa should have been either refused at the point of application or not decided until the Australian government was satisfied he met all the requirements. The government instead granted a visa, which effectively signalled to Mr. Djokovic that you have been given a legal right to enter Australia. Mr. Djokovic was seriously misled.
Paul Meek in Perth follows Australian politics closely. He suspects the Morrison government wants to create some political theater, what with elections coming up and COVID cases surging.
It's just a mess over here. For the past 18 months, we had been cut off from the world. But then they opened up the borders just as Omicron was coming on board as well. And that is the major story in Australia at the moment.
No wonder, he says, Morrison wants a distraction. Meanwhile, Djokovic is appealing the deportation order. A judge is hearing the case and will announce a decision on Monday. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Fresh violence has erupted in Colombia. This week, 27 people have reportedly been killed in fighting in Arauca on the border with Venezuela. The conflict involves a fight over drug trafficking routes. Joining me now to explain what's happening and who is doing the fighting is Sergio Guzman. He's a professor of political risk at Universidad Externado de Colombia and joins us from Bogota. Sergio, the Colombian government signed a peace deal in 2016 with the Marxist guerrilla group FARC. That ended decades of fighting. Who's involved in this current violence?
Yes, the government did sign a peace agreement with the FARC 5 years ago, but there was a faction of members of the FARC who refused to partake in the agreement and formed dissident factions of the guerrilla group and gone into drug trafficking at large. At the same time, there were other insurgent organizations such as the ELN that have a stronghold in Arauca and have not negotiated a peace deal with the government. And so it is suspected that infighting between the ELN and these FARC dissident groups is what's believed to make this conflict much more effervescent along the Colombia-Venezuela border in Arauca.
So who is being killed in this fighting? Is it members of these various groups, or is it civilians who are the casualties?
In this case, over the weekend, it was civilian casualties. People were caught in the crossfires between the groups. And so what this does suggest is that the conflict in the border areas is growing much more intense. The security situation is eroding, and this will cause much more displacement in that region.
So what are these groups fighting over?
So they're fighting for territorial control. They're fighting for the cross-border Venezuela-Colombia drug trafficking routes. As you know, Colombia is the largest producer of cocaine in the world, and these groups are trying to take the cocaine out through the Pacific and through Venezuela onto Europe, North America, and the rest of South America with alleged participation of the Venezuelan military. And so these groups are primarily fighting over who passes on the cocaine that moves from Colombia onto Venezuela and thereafter get a piece of the pie of these international drug trafficking organizations.
Is this a new development, these former members of terrorist groups getting in the drug trade, or is it something they've been involved in a long time?
Unfortunately, Carol, it's not a new development. And this situation was forewarned by many development experts, by the country's ombudsman specifically, that this could escalate. After the peace deal was signed between the government and the FARC, many fighters of this group left, and the vacuums of power that were left behind by these organizations were a huge opportunity for other drug trafficking organizations to expand their territorial control. And that's exactly what happened. And now we're at a point where this is escalating significantly and the government is paying attention. But the problem is, this was a situation that could have been prevented if the government would have taken an integral approach to the implementation of the peace agreement, promotion of territorial development and land reform in these areas to give local communities a much better sustenance of life, less illegal and illicit alternatives, and less opportunities for armed groups to recruit members.
Sergio Guzman is professor of political risk at Universidad Externado de Colombia. He joined us from Bogota. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to The World. The island of Hong Kong prides itself as the international business hub for Asia, but strict COVID rules have been a game changer, and a lot of expat business people are leaving.
In the sort of the European business community, I think 20 to 25% of the families have left in the last, say, 18 months.
How Hong Kong is losing its reputation as a financial hotspot, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World, a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. We are now officially 1 month out from the 2022 Winter Olympics. China is hosting, but with its zero COVID policy, it's not quite clear how the games will be run. With me is The World's Bianca Hillier, who has been covering the Olympics for us.
Hi, Carol.
And The World's Rebecca Canther, who's in Shanghai.
Hi, Carol.
I want to thank both of you for being here. Bianca, let's start with you. We just had the Tokyo Olympics last summer. What was the climate and conversation like 1 month out from those games?
Right. 1 month out, public opposition was really growing, and it was getting pretty loud at this point. People in Japan were marching in the streets to protest the games, and one hospital even hung a sign in their windows saying they were at capacity and the Olympics needed to be canceled. And this major concern was because of high case counts, a state of emergency in a number of prefectures, including Tokyo, and low vaccination rates. You may remember, Carol, those polls coming out of Japan that showed what percentage of people wanted the games to be canceled or postponed. It eventually rose to more than 80% of people saying they should not go on as planned. And we reported on all of this at the time, and through it all, the International Olympic Committee and the Japanese government were firm that the games would go ahead, and of course they did. But then, just 15 days out, they decided no fans were allowed in the stands.
So, Rebecca, what's happening in China right now? We're still in the middle of the pandemic. Any whiff of protests?
Not a whiff. It's a totally different vibe. Most people here don't want to protest the games, and if they did, it would be very risky for them. China's government has made these Olympics a priority, and people are going along with that. Last night, state-run evening news devoted half the show just to Chinese leader Xi Jinping inspecting the venues.
So, Rebecca, what are we hearing there?
So this is Xi Jinping watching Chinese athletes demonstrating their speed skating. Then Xi Jinping says, go get them. That was at an Olympic venue where China's Olympic COVID restrictions have already started this week. There's a closed-loop system or a bubble system that separates everyone involved, as players, media, volunteers, workers, from the rest of China. This is to help prevent a potential super-spreader event from participants coming from outside of China.
Rebecca, how will zero COVID be enforced during the games?
All athletes, workers, everyone inside the closed loop can't leave it till after the games. There's no access to the rest of China. So for people coming from outside of China, everyone has to be vaccinated or do a 3-week quarantine. There's testing every day. Face masks are to be worn at all times. There's dedicated transport between the three venue cities. This is meant to prevent the possibility of the public coming in contact with anyone inside the closed loop. Officials have already acknowledged that there will probably be some cases. So if anyone comes in contact with a COVID case, then they go into a bubble inside of a bubble.
Bianca, nearly 3,000 athletes, plus coaches, staff, and media, will be traveling to Beijing over the next few weeks. How are people reacting to the COVID situation that Rebecca just laid out? I mean, how are they preparing?
Well, right now, the worry isn't really what will happen at the games, but the worry is about simply getting to the games without getting COVID. I spoke with Brad Gajou about this. He is going to Beijing on Canada's Olympic curling team. He told me he trusts the closed loop or bubble system that Rebecca was just talking about in Beijing. But as excited as he is to get there, he's equally as anxious about testing positive before even getting on the plane. So after Christmas dinner with his parents, he went into full isolation at his house.
That's completely different from my last experience with the Olympics, where, you know, you focus on your training and how you're going to react when you get over there. But that stuff seems somewhat secondary, at least for the next 30 days. I think your first priority is making sure that you stay healthy and avoid COVID.
Let me just reiterate that for a moment. Right now, not getting COVID is a higher priority than training for a professional athlete who's about to go to the Olympics. I mean, I think that's pretty telling. And a lot of work is underway to avoid outbreaks right now. Qualifying events have been moved, postponed, or closed off to fans. But it hasn't always worked. Some Olympic hopefuls have already tested positive, including skeleton racer Akwasi Frimpong. He's from Ghana, and his Olympic dreams are effectively over because he'll now miss the remaining qualifying events for the Games. So getting COVID at this stage wouldn't just put a pause on those crucial final training sessions. It could altogether end an athlete's road to Beijing.
That's amazing. It's also amazing that there's a skeleton racer from Ghana.
Yeah, and when he competed in 2018, he was only the second ever Winter Olympian from Ghana.
Rebecca, you live in Shanghai, just a quick train ride from Beijing. Will you be going?
Well, I'm planning to go to Beijing, but a month out, the government has not really announced what they're going to do about ticket sales and spectators. So for fans in China, a lot is going to depend on things that are out of the public's control. So will China sell tickets to the public as they promised they would last year? Will the current outbreaks in Xi'an, Henan, and Zhejiang get any worse? And all of these things are going to impact whether fans can travel to Beijing and how many tickets are going to be available. And for anyone who is in the stands, Beijing officials have already said there's going to be no singing or cheering, only clapping allowed.
Wow, that's going to be different. Rebecca, you covered China's first Olympics in 2008. Compare what the buzz was like then to what you're seeing now.
It's like night and day. Back in 2008, the whole country was excited. I mean, it was China's first Olympics, and it was the Summer Olympics, and people here are way more interested in summer sports than winter sports. Now, people are not talking about the Olympics so much. I talked with David Zhang, who is in Beijing. He's a tour guide. He lives just 5 miles away from the Olympic venues, and he says the atmosphere there is also muted.
It's a big difference. Last time was really the whole city, the country is very exciting. I think people don't really pay much attention. Yeah, I cannot say excited about Olympics this time. People have a total different mode about Olympics.
A total different mode about the Olympics. I think what we're seeing is that the Winter Olympics are not as important to Chinese people as they are to the Chinese government.
The World's Rebecca Canther and Bianca Hillier have been speaking with us about the upcoming Beijing Olympics. The Games are set to begin in just 29 days. Bianca and Rebecca, thanks so much.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you, Carol.
Today is the traditional Christian day of Epiphany. In many parts of the world, including France, that means eating a special dessert. Reporter Leo Hornack dives into this sweet culinary backstory.
Good luck trying to stick to a New Year's diet in France this week.
I can see Raymond Blanc recipes, Galette des Rois recipe. Will you be king or queen for a day?
At this time of year, an already gastronomically obsessed nation becomes fixated on one dessert in particular, the Cake of Kings, or Galette des Rois.
And for this we need 2 puff pastries or butter, 75 grams of icing sugar.
Delicious, sugary, golden brown, crunchy. Or at least that's how it should taste, if you don't completely mess it up.
1 whole egg and 1 tablespoon of dark rum or cognac.
My partner's sister Monica has kindly agreed to talk me through a first attempt at baking a traditional galette. We're in the family kitchen on the outskirts of Paris, and as a Londoner, I'm a little nervous at taking on one of the most treasured items of French food culture. Officially, the galette is baked to eat on January the 6th, but over the centuries, French people have found that it's kind of a shame to only eat them one day a year. So, unofficially, across France, the whole of early January is Galette des Rois season.
I think it's important because it goes with the whole package of Christmas, New Year's. It's just next thing after the New Year party.
Now, why hasn't Britain got a dish like that?
In a large bowl, whisk all the ingredients. Oh, it says whisk. And mix to a smooth texture and then put in the fridge.
If you walk into any bakery in Paris right now, from the simplest corner cafe to the fanciest patisserie, you'll see galettes everywhere. But it's not just that they taste good. Each one is sold with a paper crown for the winner, all part of the ritual.
A little paper crown that you put on your head. I pretend I was really a queen, bow down everyone.
Inside each galette is a secret inedible ingredient, a fève or bean. Maybe a better translation would be prize or trophy.
It's the shape of a teddy bear. 2 centimeters. The other one, it's a little sheep.
Monica's holding up 2 tiny porcelain toys, about the size of your fingertip. She's kept them since childhood. Each are placed somewhere in the cake mix before baking.
Ah oui, so when we pull it out of the oven, we don't know where it is, so we cut it. And the one who has a piece with the fève, he's the king.
Isn't it dangerous? What about your teeth?
It's don't eat it too ferociously. Eat slowly because you can hurt your teeth if you bite it too hard.
If your slice contains the prize and your teeth survive, the paper crown is yours. And traditionally, the right to boss other family members for the rest of the day. Some parents have been reported, allegedly, to fix things so that the fève and the crown always end up in a slice going to a child. Monica has promised me that today's trophy hunt will be a fair fight.
It's a cake to share. And this is the most important part of this cake. It's a cake to share.
This is Nina Metaya, one of the most acclaimed young bakers or pâtissiers in France.
It's a cake who put all the family around the table to eat and to share something. The children love it, and until the grandparents love it. It's the cake everybody loves.
We're at her high-tech, high-end bakery in Paris. Minions scurrying everywhere, preparing galettes for delivery to families across France. And she says she's noticed a change in orders for Galette des Rois recently.
The last year, it was the best year for Galette des Rois. It was crazy because we sold a lot of Galette des Rois. A lot, a lot, a lot, a lot.
There's a reason why galettes matter to France more than ever now, Nina says. The same thing we've all been dealing with these past 2 years.
I think it's important because we were far, far from each other for a long time.
Traditions like the Fèvre and the Cake of Kings are the opposite of Zoom calls, isolation and social distancing.
I think people want to share more with family, with friends. They miss each other and they love more food because we don't need pastry to live, but we need happiness to live.
Moment of truth.
Okay, that's one slice. One for me, please.
And
all right.
One for me.
Our homemade galette is being tested.
Ah! Okay, I'm very excited. I just bit into a slice and I felt something hard between my teeth as I bit in. I think you all need to respect the new king at this point. Here it is.
I swear this wasn't a fix.
I am officially king for the day.
For the world... Leo Hornack in Paris.
For decades, Hong Kong has called itself Asia's world city, a bustling global business hub like no other. Or at least it was. In the COVID era, Hong Kong is different. As the world's Patrick Nguyen reports, many foreign business people based in the Chinese territory are now looking elsewhere.
First, the good news. There is very little COVID in Hong Kong. A city of similar size, New York, is seeing 60,000 new infections per day, while Hong Kong is finding maybe a dozen. And even though the territory is a part of China, where COVID-19 emerged, it has never had to go into a severe lockdown. Here's Hong Kong resident Jan Willem Muller.
Schools haven't been closed. People can exercise, can basically do whatever you want. And of course, that's an amazing benefit.
So why doesn't he sound more upbeat? Well, Muller is the chair of the Dutch Chamber of Commerce in Hong Kong and on the board of the European Chamber, representing many foreign business people who, by and large, are fed up with Hong Kong's zero COVID strategy. It has ruined their way of life, flying around Asia to make deals or jetting to their home countries on holidays. They can leave Hong Kong. The problem is getting back in.
The period for quarantine is 3 weeks now. So you're stuck in a room for 3 weeks.
Not just any room, a government-approved hotel room. Hong Kong is notoriously crowded, so even nice hotel rooms are tiny and expensive, too, like $1,500 for 3 weeks in a little room with no windows. Or if you want a luxury hotel, that's $10,000. And fresh air is usually not included.
Without medical declarations from your doctor, most hotels won't even allow you to open your window.
Jan Willem Muller says quite a few multinational businesses are done. They're pulling out of Hong Kong, some moving to other Asian financial hubs like Singapore.
If I have to give you a percentage, I would say that in the sort of the European business community, I think 20 to 25% of the families have left in the last, say, 18 months.
But the discomfort of some well-paid expats, is this really the most tragic result of the pandemic? Muller says, of course not.
Yeah, I'm not going to argue here that people should care because, I mean, it's a complicated topic. But of course, Hong Kong is an international business center. It always has been from the very start.
That, he says, is the critical point. These rules are rapidly changing the territory's identity, and they go against the vision projected by Hong Kong officials.
So they're aiming to be an international trade center. They're aiming to be an international finance center. They're aiming to be an international dispute resolution center and so on.
Hong Kong leaders say the territory is still special, that the former British colony will keep its own system of laws and customs, making it a perfect gateway to China and Asia as a whole. But in reality, Hong Kong is increasingly synced up with rules in mainland China, rules that are authoritarian, controlling people's daily lives. Muller says the political environment can be another factor for executives deciding whether or not to stick around Hong Kong.
Business people are very pragmatic, so some people might not like what's going on in terms of the political situation.
But ultimately, they've come to make money and for a certain lifestyle. For business people, the real deal breaker is staying in a tiny room for 3 weeks, separated from family every time they want to travel. Executives and diplomats have complained it hasn't done any good. It seems Hong Kong officials just can't go against China's zero COVID strategy. Even officials who want to maintain the city's character as a freewheeling business hub.
If you keep Hong Kong closed, of course, that's going to go away. And at some point, you know, Hong Kong is no different than any other city in mainland China or the region.
Now, just today, Hong Kong leaders said the Omicron variant has arrived, so they're banning flights from numerous countries, including the U.S. As for when the territory might finally allow people to come in without quarantine, this is the big guessing game in Hong Kong. One government advisor says it'll be this summer. Others say not until 2023. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
If you were hoping to make it to Brazil next month for carnival celebrations, you might have to rethink your travel plans. Many Brazilian cities, including Rio de Janeiro, have canceled their massive parades for the second year in a row. Rising cases of the Omicron variant of the coronavirus are pushing the country into its third wave. Reporter Michael Fox has our story.
Daniela Castellan lives in a three-bedroom house in Sao Paulo with her husband and two young girls. Just after Christmas, they came down with something. We had light symptoms, she says. One of my daughters had a fever. My seven-year-old had a bad cough. We were all congested, and we all had a cough, and that's why I believe it was Omicron. She says they couldn't get tested because COVID tests are either hard to come by or really expensive. So they've been isolating at home. This is the story in Brazil today. COVID-19 is back with a vengeance after months of respite where it seemed like the end of the pandemic was near. Many Brazilians brought in the new year partying like COVID was a thing of the past. People packed beaches for celebrations in Rio de Janeiro. In a small tourist city in southern Brazil, partygoers rolled across town nightly on a double-decker bus covered in neon lights. No one wore a mask. We're going to have an absurd number of cases, infectologist Marcos Casero said during an interview shared online last week. We're going to pack the emergency rooms. This is a fact. This will happen, he said. Public hospitals in the state capital of Belo Horizonte are at capacity. Hospitals elsewhere are also filling up. Brazil isn't just facing the Omicron variant, which now accounts for a majority of COVID-19 cases in the country, but it's also battling a flu outbreak. Dozens in Sao Paulo alone are infected right now with both viruses at the same time. Larissa Brusa is a microbiologist who works with the country's largest private sector laboratory. She says, we're hearing stories from colleagues that there are patients with COVID, with the flu, with rotavirus and RSV. There are people with four different viruses like this at the same time. It's insane. We weren't expecting this, and it's very concerning, she says. Here's the thing. According to the numbers, cases are still relatively low in Brazil. But that's because there are no official figures. Since a hacker knocked out the country's COVID-19 reporting system in mid-December, government numbers have been largely offline. Melanie Fontes Dutra is a biochemist and a researcher with the COVID-19 Analysis Network. She says, I'm very concerned about this blackout of information. This leaves us blind for what's happening around us, and it's hard for us to develop effective measures to stop cases, hospitalizations, and deaths from rising. If there is a silver lining, after a slow start, Brazil's COVID-19 vaccination program has been a success. The government says 80% of the eligible adult population is fully vaccinated.
Hoje é dia importante.
Yesterday, Health Minister Marcelo Quiroga announced that vaccines were finally approved for children over five. He said they would start to be distributed in the coming days. Cities have reinstated mask mandates. Sao Paulo is now requiring that all state employees be vaccinated. These measures to stem the spread of the virus are increasing as the country steers into another COVID-19 wave. For The World, I'm Michael Fox.
India has seen an uptick in a disturbing new form of online sexual harassment. This week, police arrested at least three people connected to an app that claims to have Muslim women available for sale. The app targeted prominent female Muslim journalists, photographers, and activists in India. Their photos had been placed on the app without their permission in a fake auction. Karatalan Rebar is among the women who were targeted. She's a Kashmiri freelance journalist based in India and joins us now to talk about this. Karatalan, can you explain how you found out you were listed on the app?
So I got a call from a friend, and she's also a journalist, and she told me about the incident. She said that she found my name in the list where women were auctioned online for sale. And later I saw that not just me, there were more female journalists, activists, and other prominent women, especially Muslim women, who were targeted.
Did the app have your name or also your photo?
It has my Twitter ID, and it also had my photo, Twitter photo, I guess.
What was your reaction when you saw this app and you saw your name and picture on it?
I don't expect any good coming from the country because, I mean, a lot of things are happening. I mean, it's not just crime against women, you know, like Islamophobia, and these Hindu religious leaders are giving genocidal calls. But yeah, I was shocked. I was numb. I was just thinking that how could my name be there, because it disturbed my mental peace.
What did you do once you learned you were on this app?
I mean, I just kept myself locked in a room, and I was thinking what should be my reaction. Previously in 2021, similar incident had happened, and that time I had written about it. So I shared my story, and I said that last year I did report on victims who were attacked, but now I am the victim. So it was like I am a storyteller, and now I have become a story.
Why do you think you were a target?
First of all, because I'm a Muslim. I'm a woman and I'm a journalist. Maybe these three things make me vulnerable in a place like India. These Hindu radicals, they also feel quite threatened when we speak. They sort of want to silence us, and they want to sexually harass Muslim women. I feel like this is a cyber terrorism to silence brave and outspoken Muslim women. And that's what I feel.
Cyber terrorism. That's a strong word. What do you want the Indian government to do about this?
Well, I feel like they should actually arrest the main culprit who are behind it. Also, there should be some responsibility from GitHub, which is, you know, software where these apps were made. I feel their responsibility as well to not give a platform to hate crimes against minority.
Will these kinds of incidents keep you from doing your reporting? I mean, has it affected how you're going to go about your work?
Obviously. I mean, to be honest, because I'm also from Kashmir, you know, things are quite different from mainland India. This is something which has doubled my challenges. It has made me more vulnerable right now. If you see how journalists in Kashmir work, I mean, we work under tremendous pressure from authority. Local media has been silenced.
You're already living under extreme circumstances as a Kashmiri journalist.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the thing. And now it's something which has increased my risks and vulnerabilities.
Karatalan Rebar is a Kashmiri freelance journalist based in India. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills, and we'll see you back here tomorrow.